Okay, so some of you already know Charlie. You don't need an introduction, but I'll just give a short one. So I should also say, if you don't know me, I'm Colleen Kane, and I'm a researcher at the University Center for Social and Urban Research, but I know most of you already as well. So right now, Charlie is an independent strategist, consultant, and also a senior fellow at the Northeast Midwest Institute, which is based in Washington, D.C. Previously, this is a very important job. He was a political appointee in the role of senior advisor to the assistant administrator at EPA. And legend has it that he was part of the first conversation that came out with the word brownfield. And
the true legend.
And since then, so much of his work has been for developing brownfields as a field of study and a field of policy. If you mention his name at any brownfields event, people know who Charlie Bartsch is. And I also have a connection personally to Charlie because I worked at the Northeast Midwest Institute for about 6 years. And on probably my second day, someone said, you need to call Charlie and talk to him, because I was working on urban issues. And ever since then, Charlie was just such a mentor and a connector and kind of a rarity in D.C., someone who is humble and unassuming, even though he's a superstar in his field.
You should word mentor. That just implies an old person. I'm really happy to be here. I mean, we're just coming off of, a very successful National Brownfield Conference here in Pittsburgh. From last Monday until yesterday, so I'm really jacked in this issue area. And Colleen and John asked me to just kind of talk for a few minutes about, what's going on now. Just kind of have more of a conversation about what's happening in the world of brownfields and in the new administration, and just sort of some of the different things that are going on. So I just wanted to, that's what I'm going to do. I just want to talk about some of the current redevelopment climate because the word I use is volatile. Not bad, it's volatile. And then talk about some of the EPA programs, where we're at, give you a sense as to what could happen, what might happen, a little bit of history going back to the beginning of the Trump time and how that's sort of evolved. And then just to kind of lay out just here, I just want to lay out some of the funding. For those of you that are working with communities, one of the drums that I've beaten for years is the fact that, if you really want to do successful brownfield redevelopment, you've got to go way beyond EPA and your hunt for resources to kind of carry out what you want to do. And so I'm just going to just give you some numbers just to give you a sense, because actually things for at least next year are looking pretty good in the funding side for a lot of things that do have an impact on brownfields. I'm going to talk about the impact of tax reform, where it may not be such a good news. Last Thursday, the House approved brownfields reauthorization. I want to talk about some of that. And then just some trends that I've just identified just, talking with people this week and in the past couple of months, and just kind of try to put this maybe together somehow. I don't know if the circle will be totally closed and that will be totally tied. I mean, I never really learned how to tie my shoes, so why would I know how to tie knots together for Pennsylvania's communities? But we're going to talk about what some of that means, too. So today's climate, there's a lot going on. That can impact contaminated property or sustainable redevelopment transactions. And there's, a number of things that would concern practitioners. You know what? I should start with, 10 people. I should get introductions. This is why I should never be, the first moderator. But so just to get some, who you are and, maybe your connection to brownfields, whatever it may be.
I am Ellen Kinney. I'm currently working in UXER. But I work in exposure science, health exposure science,
okay.
Mainly doing GIS. I really don't know much about brownfields, but I'm interested in learning about it.
Right. That actually gives me, I should just stop then and just do a general definition in 20 seconds or less. I mean, federal statute and certainly practice in communities and certainly EPA's, approach to this is a brownfield is basically a piece of property where real or perceived contamination affects its ability to be reused for something new. And what we've always found for years and years, it's that perceived part which so often makes it, interesting and challenging to deal with. I mean, if it's really contaminated, you kind of know there's something to deal with. The perceived is just a little different. I mean, I could have a property, I think it's great. Colleen looks at it and she goes, oh my God, it's got all sorts of crap in it. Well, she's not going to buy it. And so even though it may not be nothing there, I mean, it's that perceptual risk is a big deal. Yeah.
Risky. Quick introduction.
Yeah.
I'm do that. Chris Bray, I'm just an economist also here at Exeter. My role focuses on regional economic development, really sort of the focus on Pittsburgh's change over the last 30 years is part and parcel with a lot of brownfield redevelopment. So.
I'm Donnie Bob Walter from IUP, and for the last year I've been working with Lance Grable, who you may have met at a conference in Beaver County, and I've been doing some transportation network analysis, trying to figure out accessibility issues as they relate to the significant brownfield redevelopment issues.
Transportation programs, I think, even how things could change, are going to be, to use that great, one of my favorites, that big enchilada in a lot of these potential possibilities.
Hi, I'm Jen Missel. We met.
We've met.
I forgot, I wasn't here when you asked. Did you want us to say something
name,
about
some of your interest or connection to the wonderful world of brownfields?
Oh, gotcha. Well, I support Sabina in the brown bag seminars, so that's why I'm here.
Okay.
But I'm very interested in hearing about all of these topics, including yours, so welcome.
Okay, we'll go this way and we'll end up with Brady. How's that?
Sabina Dietrich at Upsir and Gispia, and welcome, Charlie.
Thank you.
Sandra Whitehead, I work with the National Environmental Health Association. We're the national association that represents the folks who inspect your food, your water, and your air, and make sure that you are safe in those environments. And I work with EPA and ATSDR to engage public health in brownfields redevelopment.
Ann Carroll, Office of Brownfields and then Revitalization in the EPA. I'm our public health lead for the national program and also our research coordinate contact in our coordination with our Office of Research and Development
and actually,
outside researchers.
And one of my oldest buddies in the brownfields world. So,
I'm Justin Belton. I work for Pittsburgh Community Reinvestment Group and working on a loan that provides purchase rehab for old houses getting back on the market, provide some wealth for families, and I'm here just to get an idea of the brownfields, mix between the environmental side and the community development side.
Oh, sorry. My name is Maria Barba, and I'm a student at Credit Union studying public policy and management with a focus on environmental policy, and I'm just interested in what you have to say.
Alfred Trejo, also a student at CMU, Public Policy and Management. Right now I work for the Allegheny County Conservation District, and we do a lot of testing soil to see if there's lead in like brownfields and in people's homes, and helping community agriculture and community gardens like try to use these brown spaces.
Great.
Raven Allison, I work at Exeter as a research programmer. Don't know much about brownfields, but excited to hear your presentation.
Great. So I gave you sort of the basic definition, and I guess I would just add just one more thing, which is not part of the basic definition, but that is the fact that, you know, brownfields represents a very interesting nexus between environment and economic and community development. When I worked at EPA, I mean, I would often start some of the outreach meetings we would do by really saying that, you know, in many cases, that brownfields is really step one in the redevelopment continuum. I mean, you got to deal with that before you can get anywhere else in that continuum. So, I mean, it takes on a very important role in community revitalization for a whole host of a whole host of new uses. Everything from industrial to commercial to residential to things like, you know, parks, recreation, urban gardens, all those kinds of things. So it takes on a big role. And just to kind of see what what's going on now. Oh, I think this is the weather I've got today. I had to change my flight. But we're clearly at a time of regulatory uncertainty. I mean, you know, the administration is rolling back a number of rules. There may be some new rules put in place. Rollbacks are going to likely inspire a lot of legal challenges. So things are going to be kind of churning for a while. And, you know, while no one really knows, you know, where that ends up, and I'm certainly not going to debate, you know, whether or not the rule rollbacks were appropriate or not, what that all means is there's uncertainty. And when you're looking to go from step one in that continuum further on, you know, your lenders, your investors, your home buyers, whoever it may be, that makes them a little nervous, that generates risk, and that can often slow down activity or cause it to change. Another thing is, you know, in March, we weren't sure where we were going to end up with any kinds of federal redevelopment, investive funding, and incentives. you know, the what they called the first skinny budget that the Office of Management and Budget released in March really lacked a lot of the programs that are very important to brownfield redevelopment, you know, not just the EPA programs, but, you know, again, all the way through that continuum, and I'll give you some numbers a little later. So that's up there. That actually has kind of settled down. The incentives piece, however, is more in jeopardy now because of the tax reform. I am going to, you know, Congress has recognized the importance of brownfields. Like I said last week, they passed their reform package, or excuse me, their reauthorization package. And I'm not going to focus a lot on the private sector right now, but it was fascinating to me, especially the last year and a half I was at EPA, to see how many companies have really started to embrace, you know, good environmental practices and have started to really look at brownfield properties for, you know, things like everything from new industrial activity to all sorts of things without ever really thinking that they were focusing on brownfields. It was sort of like that, you know, sort of like under the radar screen. In fact, there's not time to tell my great story about, you know, I actually was very fortunate. I did a lot of work on the White House Manufacturing Initiative, which focused on helping communities to prepare for new industrial activity. And sort of the long and the short is when that initiative started, no one really cared where that activity went. And it was by really kind of working with some of the private companies to get them to understand that, you know, we end up using the term, you know, former industrial legacy sites, a lot longer than brownfields, but the private sector got that, and they really started looking at those kind of properties in the context of the proximity to transportation infrastructure, you know, nearby workforces. You know, many of these kind of places are located near, you know, research universities, and so they really started to take the look that they needed to at those kind of properties. So there's been a lot of very interesting private sector activity, and we can talk about that in questions. I didn't include that in this, but it's an important factor in terms of this redevelopment climate. Now, this is, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because this has really evolved so much, but just to give you a sense, in, you know, in March, this is really where the OMB first budget came from. It caused for a very significant cut to EPA's budget, and then the passback was even worse. The basic process is that the agencies make the request to OMB. You know, OMB, they're just such bullies there. And they generally take everybody's cost, you know, request and cut something out of it. This is what they passed back. They also called for a significant staffing reduction. They said that EPA should focus on its core legal requirements, which from a brownfield context was not a good thing because, you know, core legal requirements are, you know, making sure Superfund is dealt with, you know, making sure that, you know, the air is breathable, and it really didn't get into some of these things like brownfields that have a big significant environmental impact, but they're not really directly a core requirement. And obviously they're talking about, you know, dealing with regulations, but I think one of the things that was potentially, you know, very serious is that, you know, that approach would have really devolved a lot of the non-core functions to the states, and of course with the states you get a lot of variation in what happens. So this is where they started out. And I also want to mention, you know, not that all of this stuff has happened, but this is what the administration can do without congressional concurrence. I mean, they can leave political positions unfilled. Right now, there's been no one nominated to the assistant administrator job in the Office of Land and Emergency Management where Brownfield sits. And actually, I haven't even heard any even rumors or nuggets about anybody being nominated. And so what that means is that a lot of the political decision-making, and again, everything at some point, it goes through the career process, but it does need political leadership sign-off. Well, what's happening now is that's all going to the administrator's office. So it's kind of a step removed from the career people like Ann that's really dealing with a lot of this stuff. One of the things that you know, still can play out is they can change enforcement priorities. I mean, you know, Congress can tell them to do a lot of things, but generally enforcement discretion is reserved to the executive branch. I don't have any immediate EPA examples where that has changed, but even today in the news, I mean, the Consumer Finance Board, whatever it's called, the one that Cordray just left and Mulvaney is now acting up, pretty much announced today that they were going to kind of go a little easier on Wells Fargo in the enforcement of the cases against them. And so, again, that's enforcement discretion, and so that could impact how things happen. You know, one of the things, again, that this will happen on an ongoing basis is, you know, Congress provides the money to EPA to carry out its programs, like the brownfield program, but it's within the agency. I mean, that's where they do things like decide, you know, what are the funding priorities within the statute that they're going to pursue in any given year. You know, they can modify the guidance documents that define how the funding should be spent, you know, if there's any priorities. And, you know, so not that I'm saying this is any of this is going to happen, but it could. And so you need to keep alert for that. For example, Brownfield's area-wide planning was a discretionary priority within the Brownfield program. Sustainable communities was one that was pretty much pretty discretionary within EPA. A lot of other offices fed money into that process. That could change. Same thing with renewable energy. And even the environmental justice. Well, I guess I got that down here, so I'll just wait. Because that really leads to the next thing, internal administrative actions. I mean, you know, as part of just running the agency, EPA can do a lot of things. I mean, not that they're going to do all this stuff, but they could. You know, they can realign staff within offices. And in fact, they've already pulled the environmental justice crew out of the Office of Enforcement and put it directly in the Office of the Administrator. This is my off-the-record, so they can keep a closer eye on them. But but they've done those kinds of things. So these things have happened. And this is, I think, probably one of the, I think, sort of, I could say, saddest things that they can. I mean, obviously, they're trying to cut staff so they can offer early retirements and buyouts. And so just my personal example of that, in the Brownfields office, Debbie Morey, who some of you may have worked with, who've been there for probably, I think she was like 35 years. I mean, she spent a lot of time, certainly the last 15 years at least of her career in the Brownfields office, probably did the work of four people. And she took a buyout. I mean, they made it so that she would have suffered a pretty serious financial loss had she stayed. So there's these things that can be done. I should also say, if anybody has any questions along the way too, let me just shout them out. I mean, that's the great value of having slides. You can just stop and start. So then we get down to issues of appropriations of funding. So this is, so I've laid out, what EPA can do on its own, what the initial proposals for EPA were. Well, a lot of it really comes down to the money that may be available for these programs. And we're kind of at an interesting point this year. I mean, across the board, OMB proposed levels that Congress has clearly not accepted and has really built back up. There's no question that these funding different things is, I mean, this is really the building blocks of brownfield revitalization. I mean, this is really, they're sort of the core of the financing partnerships that allow, sites to be not only assessed but also cleaned up and reused for something else. You may have heard this, yesterday, the House and Senate passed a two-week extension of appropriations, so we're not going to shut down today and can get home. So they pushed that to the 22nd of November. I mean, I could almost hear the collective scream from the staff on Capitol Hill as those thousands of holiday plans are disrupted because they're all going to have to stay there now to right before Christmas. And I haven't heard that Trump signed it yet, but there was no indication that he was not going to sign it. I mean, I haven't looked in the last hour, but at least he has till midnight anyway, so... Again, but the appropriations are really one of the critical building blocks. Stuff came out pretty good from that initial really kind of sad story. I mean, just to give you a sense as to where the Brownfields program totals lay out, as you can see, some actually pretty interesting things. These are the totals for, what was enacted for this year, what's proposed House and Senate. excuse me. In terms of some of the major grant stuff, House and Senate are kind of, everybody's at least at this year's level, so that it would be extraordinarily unlikely that they would dip below that, and it could even go up a little bit. I mean, the House, especially a lot of members of the House, really understand the value of those bricks and mortar assessment and cleanup grants in their communities, and they actually put in more money. Actually, this is probably, it's not like I looked at every program funding, but I would bet that this has got to be one of a handful of programs that the House put an increase in funding in for next year across the government. An important thing for states, you know, the 128A funding, which allows them to, you know, support their volunteer cleanup programs and do some other things, pretty much level. So that's in good shape, too. And I think this is a key thing, too. This is where a lot of the technical assistance funding flows, you know, a lot of the support stuff. I know several people are, you know, focusing on things like, you know, urban gardens and health issues, you know, health issues. Well, a lot of those research resources and other resources come out of this pot of money, and it was really very good to see that there may not be much change. So Brownfields is in great shape funding-wise for next year. And I also want to just lay out, I'm not going to go through every number, but these are some of the major federal programs that support Brownfields once you get beyond that step one of the redevelopment process to get to steps two, three, and so forth onward. You know, they may help with cleanup, they certainly can help with redevelopment, and they can do a lot of different things. I mean, you know, everything from, some mix of these can do everything from, you know, acquisition to cleanup to demolition to debris removal, you know, to planning, you know, to all sorts of things. And the numbers here also are really pretty good nationally. This was one of the things that was really threatened early on, the Community Development Block Grant Program, which I'm here, I think where a couple of you guys are working, I'm guessing there's some CDBG money kind of wiggles its way into that. So this is actually in great shape. EDA, the Economic Development Administration, does a lot of its program funding, deals with distressed areas, deals with planning.
Charlie, why do you think there's such a difference between the House and Senate for EDA?
You know, that's a good question, because the House has always been sort of the bailiwick stronghold of EDA. You know, I'm gonna answer that this way. I don't think that there was a lot of strength in the committee, and I think that these numbers were set at the committee level. That is my guess. I don't know. I mean, that's a good question. I mean, that's actually a pretty big, that's a big chunk, $100 million out of that program. I'm guessing that at the end it's probably going to end up pretty close to the Senate numbers. But I saw that too, and the only thing I can think of was just the composition of the committee.
And you're assuming the administration number of requests aren't going to sneak back in there when they reconcile?
They can't. They won't. I mean, they're going to work with their own numbers. I mean, that's been quite clear. I mean, I just wanted to get that in there just to give you a sense as to how much Congress has really deviated and bumped up the stuff and recognized the need. You know, it's actually very interesting. A lot of the funding, I mean, on the EDA, I put national totals in because once they go to conference, I mean, they can kind of, within the broader agency totals, they can wiggle around a bit. I know the House eliminated a lot of the, what I call special project type things out of EDA in their funding, like the cluster stuff and some of those things. They were pretty solid on public works. So, transportation, I've done a lot of presentations and trainings where I focus on DOT, which can be just basically a royal pain in the ass to deal with in terms of dealing with, you know, the NPOs and all that process. On the other hand, I think that it's going to be really worth all of our while to try to figure out how to deal with some of that better, because their money is big. DOT's brownfield policy still is. I mean, it's a policy they articulated almost 10 years ago, but that policy is that if I can't remember it word for word, but it's basically if you're going to do a transportation project, you know, do a road, do a transit, you know, facility, do whatever, and the property that's most appropriate for that project happens to be contaminated, you can use the transportation money to clean it up. And there's been a lot of examples of that. And I'm saying this knowing that it can be a real pain to kind of work through the NPO process. It can take a long time, but it may be worthwhile. This is money with a B. This is a lot of money. And so, and it's been interesting too that really about the only thing that really has suffered in this is the transit stuff in the House. But even the Senate, I mean, we're still pretty close to, you know, where we were. And so it's just, a useful thing. I don't think I'm happy to leave these slides behind. I mean, if you want to copy them onto something, because there's a lot of it's just numbers.
Sure, we'll add it to our UXR website under the brown bag.
Okay. Yeah, and the last one I want to mention is USDA Rural Development. This is the USDA programs are interesting. they're big, or they, and it really depends on the state as to how effective they've been used. I mean, the state office director has a key position in sort of the USDA hierarchy. You know, they have a lot of decision-making authority. I don't know how that person is here in Pennsylvania, but I can tell you if we were kind of a couple states over in Indiana, I mean, Indiana has done a hell of a lot of brownfield projects with these two programs because at least they're, I'm not sure that person's even still there, but she really got it. I mean, she really understood the linkage between rural development and the fact that you often needed to do site preparation that included cleanup. And that's how she wanted, you know, that's how she cast it in her mind, you know, site preparation that needed cleanup to move forward. And so some interesting figures. So community facilities can be used for everything from, you know, upgrades to water and sewer facilities to building a firehouse to, you know, those kinds of things. And the business and industry program is one of the few federal economic development, maybe the only federal economic development program where business can directly apply for it. Again, it's a loan guarantee program primarily, but they can directly apply, and that loan, that guarantee value, that guarantee incentive has really pried loose a lot of private money, which has been used for cleanup as part of the broader economic development picture. And Anne, you probably, I mean, there's been actually a number of, you know, farmers co-ops and farmers markets have used this program to kind of get the money they needed to kind of get the space ready. So there's a lot of ways in which you can kind of work this stuff in. I want to take a minute to talk about tax reform because this could be awful for brownfield revitalization across the country. I mean, they're moving ahead. They have determined, now that I think the target I saw today is they want to get tax reform done by December 19th, which if they can do that in the context of appropriation on December 22nd, I hear even more screaming coming from the staff over there. But I guess the important thing is there's some differences out there. But this is really the bottom line. I'm going to go through some of the changes in a minute. Depending on how it works out, how these differences between House and Senate are resolved, it's the tax code revision is really poised to make taking risk less attractive and less rewarding. So the question is, what does that mean for brownfield financing, which really is so much reliant on sort of managing risk and coping with risk? You know, I use this example at the Brownfield Conference when I was talking about this. Colleen is a real estate developer. She wants to, you know, she's interested in doing housing. Okay, so she could, you know, with no incentives in place, you know, now, she could build lots and lots of single family homes way out in Moon County. Am I getting that right?
Moon Township.
She could build them all out there, or she could say, you know, maybe I'll consider taking a contaminated piece of property in downtown Pittsburgh and putting, you know, mixed income development there. You know, recognizing that she's going to deal with lower income people, that, you know, and that kind of issue, she's going to deal with contamination. So with no incentives in the tax code, what makes sense for her to do? Of course she's going to go out to the township. And so that's my big concern, is that the folks out there that understand how brownfields are done, they're going to lose the incentives. I mean, it's just not going to be viable for them to take on the risk because they don't know how it's going to work out. That's my big fear with some of this tax code stuff. The House tax reform bill, as passed, would eliminate every single tax incentive that has been used as part of a brownfield financing package. It would eliminate new markets tax credits.
In community development.
Yeah, well, actually, that's true. Yeah, I should. Yeah, that's definitely true because these are all used for the same stuff. I mean, new markets tax credits, it would actually capture back the awards that were made a year ago in November if they haven't been put out on the street yet. I would actually take it all back in addition to not funding them in 2018 and 2019. It would do away with historic rehabilitation tax credits, probably in a lot of areas, one of the most significant financing tools out there, especially in places in places that have, you know, sort of a history, not to use the word, but have a history, you know, of older structures like Pittsburgh, like Philly, like all across the Northeast Midwest region that have used these. not to get too into the weeds on this, but this is actually a very interesting tax incentive because it works so well with smaller projects. I mean, a lot of these tend to go, you know, to the bigger projects, and that's fine. But these, half the projects that that use this credit are less than $1 million in size. I mean, they're actually quite small. So this is bad. There's a 10% non-historic rehabilitation tax credit in place. That would go. Low-income housing tax credits that are partnered with tax-exempt bonds would go. Renewable energy investment tax credit would be eliminated. And this one for community development, for infrastructure, for things like building college facilities and hospitals and schools and all that, the tax exemption for private activity development bonds would go as well. Not good stuff. And it also cuts the renewable energy production tax credit, you know, I didn't do the percentage, I guess, but from 2.4 cents per kilowatt hour to 1.5 cents. So significant bad impacts. In fact, I almost wanted to do this, like, remember, because we're on a college campus, you know, that the scene in Animal House when John Belushi is getting ready to confront the Deltas and he's going, New Markets tax credit's dead! Non-historic, dead! You know, I mean, it's just not good. The Senate, I mean, again, they've named the conferees, so they're going to have to work this out. I'd be happy to answer questions. There's all sorts of arcane rules that are going to govern what goes and what stays and how much, you know, value it has and how they kind of stick to the $1.5 trillion in deficit increase that they're allowed. But this is where the Senate bill is. It would actually keep these. It would kill them off after 2019, but at least we'd have a couple more rounds to work with, and it would also allow the 2017 round to the 2016 round to go ahead. It would keep the historic rehabilitation tax credit, but people would now have to claim it over 5 years. I mean, right now, you know, you do your project, you get certified, you get this nice credit. Well, now you would have to get your credit over 5 years. There's a bunch of negatives that go in with that because right now, the recapture is going to be extended, so you're going to actually hold on to that product or that project or that property, excuse me, even longer before you could sell it. So people that will be using that credit under the Senate bill are going to have to know that they're going to really keep it for a while so that they don't lose the credit. The non-historic is repealed. The low-income housing tax credit is retained. That's a good thing. The renewable energy investment tax credit is retained, as is the production credit. No, this is wrong. This is a typo. It keeps the renewable production at the same 2.5 cents. This reduce should not be there. And it also, very importantly, keeps the tax exemption for private activity development bonds in pretty much every case. So the Senate bill is much better. It's all about how they put it together for a final package. I should also mention, too, that, you know, not that I'm taking any sides in this, but the House Republicans have been adamant that the estate tax be totally repealed, and the Senate had proposed just an increase in the level that you could claim before it kicked in, and that actually represents about a $50 billion difference in the value of the tax packages. And what's really kind of sad is that a couple of these things would I mean, that $50 billion, you could keep a couple of these if you kept the estate tax. Retain some limit on the estate tax. So that's what's really kind of unfortunate about that, but I'm not lobbying. Well, I guess I can do that now, can I?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm happy to answer questions on any of that stuff. Congress. This is Peter Meyer, Brownfield Gadfly, formerly University of Louisville.
Whatever, a one-time collaborator with this young lady.
That's right. Anyway, you came in at a great time, Peter, because we're talking about brownfield reauthorization. Now, the original statute that authorized brownfields expired a number of years ago. This is the law that was passed in 2002. EPA has continued its program because it gets funding from Congress. You know, they've made some administrative changes along the way, you know, identified some priorities. This is what passed the House on November 30th. And I should just also mention that on the Senate side, which this was kind of interesting because there had always been more interest on the Senate side for reauthorizing it. Their act has actually passed out of committee. They're waiting for floor action. it's pretty much the same stuff. I just want to mention what the House bill does. It maintains the authorization at the current levels, you know, $200 million for projects and project grants and program administration, $50 million for states, you know, to support the voluntary cleanup programs. Now, of course, you'll remember, they haven't gotten that much. I mean, remember those numbers going back? Haven't quite gotten that much, but, you know, it's still there.
Hey, Charlie, maybe you could explain the difference between authorization and appropriation.
Sure. Yeah. An authorization is the level that Congress allows a program to receive in money. So it's sort of like, you know, if they say $200 million, what they're doing is they're telling Congress, you can give that program up to $200 million. Doesn't mean they have to do it, but they're allowed to. And in the case of brownfields, they've never gone up to the allowed level that they had. A couple of other things. It makes orphan petroleum sites eligible for grants. One of the big issues with petroleum brownfield sites is that it's quite a cumbersome process to, you know, to kind of close all the, I guess you don't close I's, you dot I's and cross T's, whatever one does with letters. You had to do a lot, there was a lot of steps you had to go through to make sure that there was actually no real owner of the property, you know, before you could declare it an orphan site to become eligible for grants. They've really streamlined that. They've expanded nonprofit eligibility. You know, the existing law does not allow nonprofits to apply for site assessment grants. They can apply for cleanup grants, but not site assessment. Of course, in many cases, site assessment is sort of actually, pretty much all cases, it's the first step in the process. And now they can do that. And what's really important about that is that it really kind of opens up the brownfield process to a lot of, you know, redevelopment authorities. Actually, you guys, you're working with nonprofits. I mean, you would be eligible under this new law to actually to apply for a grant. You know, you're working on, like, you know, your urban, you know, the urban garden or the farmer's market, and you have a property. Well, now you would not have to go through machinations to, you know, to that was my flight being canceled again. It increases the amount of grants. Right now, the limit on grants is generally $200,000. It would increase it to up to $500,000. It allows multi-purpose grants for up to $1 million. So that means, going back to the farmer's market, say you actually identified a site you needed to figure out was there, and then you're going to have to do some cleanup. It would actually allow you to apply for all of that activity in one grant. Right now, they're staged over on annual allocations. The theory behind that is you can actually get things done quicker. You don't have to wait, you know, apply 1 year, wait a year, apply for the next one. It clarifies liability for local governmental entities. Right now, one of the big issues is that communities, you know, local government entities that may have acquired properties like old gas stations, like old dry cleaners, years and years ago, you know, because of tax forfeiture or someone just walked away from it and they just took title, the current law would consider them an owner or operator because they're an owner, they took it. The revised law, the new reauthorization would clarify that and allow them to be eligible for grants. It would provide technical assistance for small communities, and it would require EPA to consider potential for renewable energy when ranking grant applications. And a big thing, administrative costs. The current law does not allow applicants to use any of the money at all for admin, and the reauthorization would allow 5%. So that's also a good thing. I guess I just want to lay out, you know, sort of, I guess what I call up here on the slide, a conceptual look at some of the possible impacts and viability. These provisions have been sort of worked on, worked through by EPA, by a lot of, you know, interest groups like the Conference of Mayors, League of Cities, a lot of environmental groups. So it represents, you know, a lot of their thinking and a lot of what they'd like to see in a reauthorization. And I guess I just want to take a sort of a step back now that there's actually those provisions that are getting closer to enactment, just to see what impact some of them might have with respect to the current program and the current law. Certainly expanding the eligibility is a good thing because it really reflects sort of the nature of public-private partnerships and real estate development trends and opportunities and who's playing in that game. It really makes up, and I keep looking at you because, I mean, you're like the perfect example of what that new eligibility would allow, because it would just allow you just, you know, to just to kind of go after this and not have to add a lot of more hoops to jump through to make that work. It would also allow more certainty because it does include things like, you know, making sure that area-wide planning stays in place. It includes, like, making sure that, you know, renewable energy is considered. So what happens now is it just brings more certainty. I mean, it just eliminates what I call whim changes. So a new guy comes into, you know, the Office of Land Emergency Management, new assistant administrator, he goes, you know, I hate area-wide planning. I don't want to do it. So he just doesn't do it. Or he wants to do something else. So it really brings some certainty to that process. It allows for better some of the targeting. I mean, some of the early proposals called for really requiring EPA to give X amount of grants for renewable energy, X amount of grants for waterfront, and so forth. And when I was at EPA, I mean, we really fought that kind of earmarking and targeting, because you carve up the program that many ways, there's not a lot left for more general things. And I think this was our big thing. These things all emerged over time as communities had opportunities they were dealing with, you know, that came up. I mean, you know, 20 years ago, a lot of renewable energy stuff, A, didn't really exist, and B, required very different, you know, land and site setups to work, and that's changed. And the same thing with stuff like green infrastructure. And so by targeting all this stuff, by putting in law that EPA has to, you know, give 4 grants for waterfront or 10% of its money, you know, for green infrastructure, it really hamstrings their flexibility to deal with emerging situations. So that's something that there's less of this in the bill that the House passed. Some of the early versions had a whole list of things that they wanted the EPA program to do. It also has, well, I'm just going to go back here. This actually represents a nice change in this. It allows small cities to apply for up to $20,000 in technical assistance grants. One of the original bills had those grants at $5,000. Who wants to do the paperwork on a $5,000 grant? It really comes down to that. Who in a little tiny town where you've got your town manager doing 99 things wants to do paperwork on a $5,000 grant? You're out there, you're afraid. I mean, you got probably a lot better things to do than paperwork on a $5,000 grant. I mean, it might be worth it for $20,000, but $5,000, you know. So that was a good thing. But they originally were, again, fairly small. This was a provision in one of the early bills, too, providing EPA loan staff to small and disadvantaged communities. Great idea. It was actually, it came from, you know, some of the early work that EPA did in brownfields with its showcase cities, where they basically embedded staff in the communities to help them out. Great idea. Impractical. They're cutting 20% of the staff. Where are they going to get these bodies? It's just not going to work. And then I think this is probably one of the biggest impacts potentially with the reauthorization, which is kind of combined with this. So, Colleen, I'm glad that you asked me to explain the difference between authorization and appropriation. They could authorize $50 billion for this program, and if they provide $100 million, that's what you got. Your $50 billion program is a $100 million program. They keep the authorization level at 200. They've never appropriated more than half of that for the actual grants. And I guess my concern is if we're doubling, or actually more than doubling, the size of the eligible grants, that's what EPA will give out, and that's going to have a de facto impact of cutting the number of grants they can give out on an annual basis by as much as half. That which would not be good. Right now, EPA gets 800 or 900 grant applications every year. I think they got, I think it was like 919 for the round that just closed in November. They typically can only fund about 220. Between 220 and 225, and that's going to, you know, and that's at the $200,000 level. So that's going to be a big impact. I want to take a minute to talk about some of the trends that are out there. And actually, Colleen, I can see this clock, so you don't have to wave at me for 1 o'clock. So one of the things that I think we're going to see is that, you know, depending on what happens with especially these tax code changes. And, you know, I mean, our money is good for this year. We don't know what 19 is going to bring. These are questions that are really going to be out there. So what kinds of leveraging is going to come up, you know, given sort of the new reality that we might have, you know, what kind of tools are going to evolve to replace the potential loss of federal tax incentives? And we're going to have to see, how are the states going to respond to this stuff? I mean, are they going to offer more of their own tax abatements? I mean, is Pennsylvania likely to, you know, bump up tax abatements and do all this other stuff so that you all can continue to work on your brownfield stuff? And the same thing with, you know, with the locals. I mean, what is their response going to be to some of the shifting federal tax code? Are they going to offer more local abatements? Are they going to offer more local tax increment finance to do this kind of stuff? You know, what can they do? So that's really some of the questions that are out there. Just over the last, actually at the Brownfield Conference this week and just over the last, you know, couple of months, I've just been kind of as I run into people, I'm chatting at the local level, I'll see what people are doing. Some interesting stuff is kind of, people are considering, you know, to kind of expand brownfields at the local level. Some interesting ideas. Development charges, water, sewer, wastewater charges, you know, targeting that for brownfield cleanup. Money raised from fees or fines. Let's just say, for whatever reason, I've done something and the city of Pittsburgh has fined me $10,000. Well, maybe there's a bunch of me's out there and a bunch of $10,000's. Maybe that could go into a pool like this. New Bedford, Massachusetts is doing that. They started, you know, local fines, you know, or fees related to all sorts of things. They've put into these little revolving funds to deal with brownfields. Tax liens or nuisance ordinances to encourage private site cleanup and reuse. One of the big issues is, how do you get going? How do you get that first site assessment done? How do you get a recalcitrant owner to move ahead? Again, the mayor, Elizabeth, New Jersey, Mayor Bolwaj, he's just like this brownfield dynamo. He had a property he was convinced was contaminated. He was convinced that it was causing blight in surrounding properties. He was convinced that reuse of those surrounding properties was not happening because people were concerned about what was there, and the owner wouldn't do anything. Again, it wasn't a discharge or any environmental violation that was so egregious that required like any kind of a legal or enforcement action, but Mayor Bowles was just pissed off. They wouldn't do anything. So what he did, he went right to the property, the sidewalk in front of that property, and they drilled, they did testing. They went to the ground, they tested soil, literally dug up the sidewalk in front of this place and tested soil, and when that came back contaminated, he went to them and said, "We're going." And so he kind of worked this along. And they have, there's tools that can be used to help with this. Again, the nuisance ordinances, tax liens. So there's things out there. Zoning or marketing strategies. There's been a number of communities that have allowed zoning variances for intended uses on brownfields just to kind of move them along. There was a project in Portland, Oregon, where it was, that they waived a height limit so that the developer could, and this is actually amazing, you talk about how these things, linkages, where you think what happened, don't happen. So this was in Portland, the developer of a brownfield property came in for a site variance for a building he was building. He basically wanted to make it like 9 stories tall. It was an 8-story limit, or however many heights of feet that is. And I'm hearing the story, and so someone said, well, why would that make a difference? Why would just adding a story to an office building make a difference? A lot more rent over a lot of period of time. They're renting out that whole extra floor. So for the developer, that extra rental income was worth it to him to take on that property to build. Same thing, expedited permitting and property transfers. Time is money. There's been a number of cities like Chicago that if you're dealing with a brownfield property, your application kind of rises up the list a little quicker than it might otherwise. Worth a lot to developers. And we're also seeing other things out there, insurance pools, intermediaries, and approaching, again, the area-wide planning, which is critical. Now, using the value of properties surrounding the brownfield to attract someone to use it and to increase the value. So that's really where we're at. So, noted brownfield specialist Betty Davis said, we're going to have a bumpy ride. We're in a very volatile time, but at the bottom line of all this is that public-private partnerships are key, and you really need to think creatively about ways to integrate brownfields into new areas. I mean, you really need to figure out how to put all this stuff together, no matter what you want to do, to kind of get to this center point. I was a planner by training. I love Venn diagrams. So, what this all means for Pennsylvania communities going forward. I think there is going to be less reliance on some of the federal assistance. It's going to require you to recalibrate some of your financing strategies, and you're going to continue to really need to explore creative use of resources. You're going to need to think unconventionally. You know, how can you blend all these different things together? Everything from transportation to public works to green space to garden. How can you blend all that together to really help an area deal with its brownfield situations? And what are the new resources are out there? It's going to require advocacy on all levels to support some of the tool incentive and continuation and creation. None of the brownfield tools that are out there were put into place and then immediately accepted overnight. It's an ongoing education process to help people understand why they address risk. And you need to make the best case. And this goes to what Peter Meyer's working on. You need to document results. You need to have examples. You need to show your public officials why it makes sense to invest in these things. I think that's it. Yeah, it's 1 o'clock. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Any questions? I can start.
Sure.
Okay. So what I don't understand is why when EPA asked for 25, I understand like the later process of the federal budget. What I don't understand is the ask to OMB in the first place.
Why they went so low?
So why did they ask for 25% cut? Is it because of the administrator, or they always?
They never asked for a cut like that.
So
it was just the new game coming in. I mean, that was part of the across the board. I don't know, you know, sort of mandate from the top that we need to cut the budget, we need to reduce spending, and a lot of programs. Actually, you saw the numbers, pretty much every development program took a hit in the initial Trump ask in March, and the skinny budget was, I mean, everybody took a hit.
So is there a situation where, like, a reasonable administrator, let's say a different administration, would still be asking for a cut when they first go to the OMB?
No, I think a lot of the stuff will come back. I mean, when Lisa Jackson was there, when Gina McCarthy were there, I mean, it always went higher. I mean, they asked for almost full authorization level,
okay.
and of course, then the Democratic OMB still pared that back and the pass back.
Mm-hmm.
But no, this is the first time it had been that sort of the out of the box ask was so low.
Okay.
Peter,
just an observation on that out of the box. As, which is that we've already seen, even in that literature, in the congressional budget resolution, that in fact some of the things that the administration was trying to cut out completely got put back in.
Mm-hmm.
So in a certain sense, Congress has been less in favor of the levels of cutting than has the administration itself.
Right.
Which gives you a sense of how extreme that position has been.
Yeah. Right. And we talked about that before you got here.
Oh, my apologies.
Bye. But I mean, I think it's good to reiterate that observation, and that is, you know, as you're out there working, I mean, it really does get that old Tip O'Neill thing, all politics is local. I mean, this happened because, it goes back to this point here, too. People, I mean, you need to let, you know, even if it's not lobby, you need to let people know, local congressional offices, state offices, legislative offices, that these things really are valuable, and they're just, certainly in the case of brownfields, I mean, there is a, these do bring a return on investment. I mean, EPA has the number that every EPA grant dollar, every EPA brownfield grant dollar leverages, when all is said and done, an additional $18 in public and private investment. A lot of that public investment is from those other programs that I laid out there, and certainly a lot of it is private. And I've been in meetings with OMB, and they go, you know, give me a break. There's no way that any program leverages 18-1. We always pointed out to them that, you know, think about that economic development continuum. Without the assessment, without some cleanup, all those billions and millions and zillions of dollars for development won't happen because no one wants to take the risk to find out what they're dealing with in many cases. I mean, and I think one of the challenges for this, too, is that what I just said, it also depends on location. I mean, if I'm in Midtown Manhattan, well, yeah, I probably would spend $30,000 to find out if a property, you know, had some contamination, what I'd need to deal with it. You know, if I'm in, you know, rural Luzerne County, Pennsylvania, I probably wouldn't do that. So that's why, I mean, the real value of those tools is that you can find out what you're dealing with. there's been lots and lots of cases where just a little bit of assessment money, just so somebody knew what was there, was enough to trigger all private. I mean, one of the first brownfield success stories that I'm familiar with, that I had looked at, was in Chicago. A $20,000 site assessment that the city paid for led to a private company doing the cleanup and the redevelopment, and they put like $150 million into the project. So that's a hell of a leverage on your $20,000. But it just kind of, and obviously not every case is like that, and it depends on the end use. I mean, obviously, if you really are trying to provide a very critical green space for a community, or an opportunity for a community garden in the community as part of it, that's not going to have that kind of a return. But even in the case of parks and those kinds of open spaces, you're providing the amenity value that often leads to more value for the surrounding properties and just leads to an improvement in the community area and the community quality of life. And I think that's where, a lot of these tools, I mean, brownfields is interesting because it's just so difficult to work with from sort of a documentation and a statistical and all that. I mean, if we were just doing affordable housing, it'd be real easy. We built 4 units, 20 people are living there, we spent how much dollars, and you got this very quantifiable benefit, and we can move on and evaluate the next project. But these, because of the way they pull so many things together and they're so diverse, it's really hard to document that, and that's where a lot of the trip up comes in terms of the funding request, because, even I've been in situations, someone said, how many brownfield sites are in the state of X? Well, go back to that definition. If it's perceptual, Colleen may count a lot more than me. And there's no way of, it's not like a total quantifiable way. So, there's just a lot of wrinkles to this issue, which make it challenging, but also make it really interesting, which is why I've been doing this for like 25 years. It's just, every day is different. So, yes.
Given what you just said, is there any kind of like national database that shows the locations of brownfields?
No. There's
or
not.
Is it, or like state level? Or is it?
A lot of states have tried to put together state level databases and inventories. And I should give the cue. Peter is actually working on a research project right now for EPA that would allow communities to better do some of that, better identify sites and also better identify the benefits that could accrue from reusing them in different ways. Mm-hmm. But the data has always been a real challenge. But that word perceptual in the definition. Pennsylvania actually has put together a database of sites, I don't think anybody could ever. If you ever hear anybody say I have the comprehensive list of brownfield sites, wrong, because there's just too many rooms. On the other hand, you still want to have a sense, and I think Pennsylvania's put together a very good database of sites in different places that. And I think they've actually even, I haven't looked at that in a while, but I think that they've even tried to give some senses to the condition, so which is even better, because it's all about the risk. If I kind of have an idea of what I'm getting myself into, I might be willing to take a look at it and use it, but if I don't, then, I probably wouldn't.
Would you say that most of the properties are vacant, and would you say most of them are commercial, or used to have commercial use as opposed to residential?
Depending on how you define, it's very not a lot of residential. There's some. Mm-hmm. Probably the two biggest categories are abandoned gas stations and abandoned dry cleaners. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of industrial. There is a lot of commercial. That closed down Walmart that was built in the 70s could very well, it doesn't take a lot of contamination to be contaminated.
Right.
If they had one of the interesting sets of contaminated properties out there. Like there's a lot of old Sears that had just the auto repair joints and the tire joints that were part of the Sears. Well, those are all, again, they would fall in. So I think the thing with brownfields is that, it took a long time to get the private sector and even a lot of local officials to kind of get their mind away from when you said brownfield, you really meant Superfund, and then you're talking about Gore and Ick and to think about, maybe it's a gas station, there's one tank underground that may have leaked, mm-hmm. or something like that. There's agricultural brownfields. There's been a lot of old orchards in Michigan, the old cherry orchards that had been abandoned, our brown fields because they were orchards back in the day when they used certain kind of pesticides, which then just spread it all around and it's out there. So there's all these different variations. And so when you're talking about like a program, okay, so I'm thinking my gas station, I'm thinking my steel mill, I'm thinking my orchard. I mean, how do you do a program to deal with all that stuff? I mean, it's very, or how do you measure that? I mean, is my orchard more contaminated than your gas station? We've just named two brownfield sites. Or like, think of the like U.S. Steel, you know, all along, you know, all along, you know, Lake Erie, you know, thousands of makers, or my, or your little gas station. We've named two sites. Sorry, it's interesting because, and it's hard to kind of, like I said, if we're talking about rental housing, we can count four units, and we're all, everybody's got four units, type of thing. Yeah.
All right, and the last one.
Yeah, I just wanted to add one thing to what Charlie was saying about the multiplier, for example, doing a site assessment, and this really has to do with the perception piece. And that is that a significant number of sites that get that very, very first site assessment are found to require no work at all.
That's right. That's actually a good point.
And that's something that is very, very important to keep in mind, because if you stop and think about it for a minute, a municipality putting money into assessing sites that are perceived to be contaminated, if they turn out not to be,
then you're done.
That's going to accelerate that economic development effort very, very substantially, and then maybe something where the Urban Development Authority or whoever really should be putting some money into resolving the uncertainty.
Yeah. The first few years of the EPA program that they did sites, that they gave site assessment grants, about a third of the sites were not contaminated when they did the assessment. That number's going down because people are, I think, a little more skilled at identifying targets now. But that's a lot. And even now, something just may look awful, 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 but it's actually just a bunch of crap there. It's not any you know, scrap and debris, and it's not actually any of the buildings falling down. There's nothing there from an environmental standpoint.
What about lead paint? That's what I was thinking about with the residential. Is that considered brownfield?
It would be. There's other programs. The residential is harder to use the program on, though. But given the nature, actually, I'm going to answer that this way. It's harder to use the program because, let me back them up even one more step. It's harder to actually use the program and get a grant because the grant criteria have evolved to the point where they really are looking for implementation resources. So you could find out, I mean, you have much better luck getting a grant if you're like, you know, assessing like an apartment complex as opposed to a house.
Another way of getting it is where the entire neighborhood has been bulldozed into its own basements by urban renewal, and down in the basement, what was the basement,
yeah,
now have in the soil, the lead paint,
yeah,
the lead pipes,
yeah,
and all the rest of,
yeah,
it,
and that's,
and now all of a sudden you've got lead contaminated,
right,
soil. But it's got to be a large area for that to really then pay off in terms of justifying grant funding.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Charlie.
Okay, you're welcome. Have a great time.